Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Thursday, the federal government's considering a new tax on imports. We'll explore what that could mean for online shopping. And we'll take a look at an Australian university's plans to start a record label in the hopes of promoting music that could otherwise be forgotten.
I see this label as the label that can break through really significant people who might be ignored by the mainstream industry, or the ones that can look after some of these people who've fallen through the cracks. Because we're looking to find the people whose music is still truly excellent, truly innovative.
But first, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg has spoken for the first time about the growing furor over a data scandal involving political research company Cambridge Analytica. Facebook suspended the company from its platform last week after it was alleged that users' data had been used to target voters during the 2016 US election campaign. And it says an internal investigation is underway. Antoinette Latouf reports.
It's taken several days and a $77 million drop in its stock market value for Facebook's CEO to comment about its role in the Cambridge Analytica scandal. He was interviewed by CNN.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people. Our responsibility now is to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
This morning, the billionaire also posted a lengthy statement on his Facebook page, admitting they'd made a mistake. He says Facebook will attempt to contact everyone affected.
We're going to be even conservative on that. So, you know, we may not have all the data in our system today. So anyone whose data might have been affected by this, we're going to make sure that we tell.
The social media giant is also reviewing all app companies it is connected to.
We are doing a set of things to restrict the amount of access that developers can get going forward. But the other is we need to make sure that there aren't any other Cambridge Analytica's out there.
David Vail is the chair of the Australian Privacy Foundation. He doesn't think Facebook's efforts go far enough.
Serves his own interests as well as you can do with 4 days of careful preparation of spin, but it leaves a lot of the real questions, the big questions, unanswered, including is he aware of, for instance, what did they actually do wrong? What did Facebook do wrong? How and who did this hurt? Why was that wrong? And what was the cultural source of the error? You know, what was it in their strategic plan or their business model that drove this?
He believes privacy settings are deliberately and strategically made difficult for users to keep up with.
The window dressing and the sort of the corporate happy talk that is loaded up on this, doesn't really deserve approval.
Justin Warren from Electronic Frontiers Australia is sceptical of what an internal audit, as promised by Facebook, will achieve.
Well, clearly you can control what happens with someone who's being paid by you a lot easier than you can if it was an externally appointed entity. I certainly would prefer to see someone external, because this is not Facebook's first offence. This is just one more in a long line of issues, of mistakes it has made. Personally, I don't think that they can be trusted.
Troy Hunt is an independent web security researcher.
Look, I think he ultimately got so much pressure. This thing got so much press and it was reflecting so badly on Facebook. His hand was sort of forced to come out and make a statement about it. So I'm not too surprised to see that.
He says revelations of more data breaches are likely.
I think it's interesting that obviously Cambridge Analytica is the one that is the target of this particular incident. We would likely find that there are probably other players that have been a little bit too egregious in terms of their access to personal data, but I would not be at all surprised if there are many, many others that have had excessive access, and this might be something that their internal audit finds.
Web security researcher Troy Hunt ending that report from Antoinette Latouf. Dr. Eric Talbot Jensen is a professor of international law at the Brigham Young University in Utah and an expert on cyber warfare. He's in Australia to talk to the Red Cross about how to get prepared for the threats that cyber attacks could pose. I asked him what we can all learn from the latest scandal about big data.
I think the Cambridge Analytica experience lets us know that our personal data is being used in ways that we just aren't thinking about in most cases. We think about personal protection of credit card numbers or of our financial data, but there's obviously much more about us that is influenceable by cyber operations and much more that certain people or entities can use our cyber data for. And this is a good example. The elections in 2016 in the United States, there was clearly an attempt to use big data, to use those kinds of cyber operations to influence that election. And I think that's now a way of life that we have to accept.
Overnight, we've seen Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg acknowledge this scandal. And he has said, we have a responsibility to protect your data, that the company is working to prevent similar abuses of users' privacy. Is that enough from a company like Facebook?
Well, there's long been a skepticism about what the governments would do with our personal data, but we haven't really turned the looking glass on what corporations or other entities might do with it. And I think what this has done is it has given us all a recognition that we should be concerned about not just governments, but about corporations like Facebook and Google who have access to all of our data. And I think we have to consider what kinds of assurances from those kinds of entities are sufficient. Can we trust those entities to do what should be done, what's best for us? Do we as citizens need to ask our governments to intervene to ensure those companies do what's best? Do we need to do more as individuals to protect our data and to determine where it is used and what it's used for? I think all of those are questions we need to reflect on.
And what about national laws in relation to our privacy? Are they keeping up with protecting our own information online?
Well, national laws obviously are a difficult question because each state approaches this from a different way and tries to strike that balance between national security and individual liberty differently. But I think that every state, the citizens of every state, need to consider how they want to strike that balance between liberty and national security. Do they want to have individual liberty outweigh that such that they are willing to take the risks with their data, or do they want the government to intervene and accept the risks of the government holding that data? How we strike that balance is an important balance that every state, I think, needs to grapple with. And, of course, international law then is an overlay over the top of that tries to help as well.
What is your thesis about the current state of cyber warfare around the globe?
Well, I think that cyber warfare in its most clear state is when we use cyber operations to facilitate warfare. But that happens far less than the kinds of things we're hearing about now with Cambridge Analytica, for example, where cyber operations are used to gather data, to influence elections, to try and make a difference at a level far below warfare, but still is influencing national security. So if, in fact, some of this data was used to influence an election, that is something that we need to be worried about. And if, for example, a foreign nation is now trying to use that data to influence a domestic election, that again is a real concern and something that we ought to be thinking about and trying to work against.
What should we as individuals be doing to protect our own online presences?
Well, this is a difficult question because it goes to the balance of individual liberty and national security. One way we could approach this is we could ask the government to regulate the use of our data to protect it from those who might use it when we don't want them to. That, for a lot of people, that's an equal concern. So then another option would be to ask the companies like Facebook and other companies to self-regulate. But I think this last example has given us less confidence that they'll do that and do that well. The third option is for us as individuals to be very careful about what I call cyber hygiene. Are we being very careful about what we put on the internet? Are we exercising secure measures, double authentication? Are we making sure that our data is protected and those kind of things? So there's really we can attack this from any or all of those angles, but I think it's a difficult balance to strike to make sure we attack it in the right way.
That's Dr. Eric Talbot Jensen, a professor of international law at the Brigham Young University in Utah. Well, one of the reasons we are entering our personal and credit card details into websites is for online shopping. And if you're in the habit of buying items from overseas, you could soon be paying more for them. The Department of Home Affairs is looking at whether to put a new levy on all items shipped into Australia. It argues the extra cash would help recover costs associated with biosecurity, cargo and trade border activities. Stephanie Boris reports.
With the click of a button, products can be bought at any time, anywhere. It's seen a dramatic increase in the number of parcels reaching Australia, keeping customs and biosecurity officers busy.
Agencies have found all kinds of weird and wonderful things through the network over the years, including drugs, weapons, prohibited goods.
Paul Zalai is the director of Freight and Trade Alliance, representing importers, customs brokers, freight forwarders and logistics service providers. He's supportive of the Department of Home Affairs proposal to slap a levy on all packages coming into Australia to help cover screening costs.
At the moment, the way the government agencies do that cost recovery is on the high-value consignments. So by that I mean the shipments over the value of $1,000. This concept is to remove that cross-subsidisation to put a proportion of that cost recovery fee to be collected on the low-value consignments under $1,000.
Thanks to the online shopping boom, nearly 40 million of the so-called low-value parcels, that's items worth less than $1,000, arrived in Australia last financial year. As to who will pay for the levy, Paul Zalai expects it will be the customer.
The nuts and bolts of how that will work is to be determined, and that's based on individual commercial basis. But I would assume the express couriers are the ones they're going to be billed this transactional cost recovery fee. I imagine that they will try to increase the cost at origin, and then the suppliers will probably mark up their price back to the consumer here in Australia.
Crossbench Senator David Leinhelm, a Libertarian, is opposed to the idea.
This government seems to have an endless capacity to come up with new taxes and increase existing taxes.
He says Australians shouldn't have to pay more if they're buying an item from overseas.
I despair at the idea that we'll ever end up with any of our own money left in our own pockets.
So how much extra will shoppers need to put aside to cover the increased shipping cost? No figure is provided in the discussion paper by the Department of Home Affairs and the Agriculture Department. Paul Zalai says it's ultimately up to those departments and the government.
On the back of the Coaster calculations, those costs will be more likely in the dollars rather than cents per transaction.
Are we talking, anywhere between $1 to $10, $10 to $20?
Look, I could not imagine it being over the $10 mark, but again, there's just so many factors that we don't have the transparency on to try and do the actual calculations.
But it's not just people who enjoy online shopping that will be impacted by the proposed changes. If your grandma lives overseas and sends you a handmade knitted scarf, she'll be paying more to send your gift. And the levy wouldn't just apply to items being sent via a courier company. The discussion paper states there is scope to look at imposing a cost on packages that arrive through international mail.
A Home Affairs annual fee arrangement with Australia Post, along with a low-value consignment cost recovery levy, would comprehensively address issues of cross-subsidisation and ensure fairness of cost recovery arrangements.
The Department of Home Affairs has asked interested parties and stakeholders to provide feedback on the proposal, which will then be put to the government.
Stephanie Boris reporting. And this is The World Today. If you ever miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to our podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. The ANZ Bank says it's had to deal with sophisticated fraud involving fake payslips in cleaning up its car finance business. The bank's representatives have appeared at the Financial Services Royal Commission this morning. Our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is covering the hearing and he joins me now. Peter, we've heard today that ANZ has had problems with some brokers and dealers in the car loan business, but also with some shady practices by customers.
That's right, Rachel. And ANZ sold its Asanda car loan business to Macquarie Bank back in 2015. But this morning, the Royal Commission heard that the ANZ was aware of dodgy practices before that, once again driven by car dealers rushing to get hefty commissions for signing buyers up to ANZ Bank backed car finance. ANZ was fined $5 million earlier this year after admitting that the old Esanda business breached responsible lending laws. Now, after selling Esanda, ANZ introduced a 55-minute test where car finance brokers had to score 100% to sell ANZ finance products. But ANZ executive Guy Mendelson said there was quite a bit of pushback and that 500 out of 4,000 brokers were disaccredited because they wouldn't take the test. Now, Mr. Mendelson said the problems are with a tiny fraction of loan applications, but he also said the ANZ is constantly battling things like payslip fraud that ranges from being unsophisticated to organised crime.
Fraud in general for the bank is a major focus area, be it cyber fraud, be it payslip fraud, be it bank statement fraud. We're seeing even things like salary staging, which is where people who are trying to defraud the bank will set up bank accounts and create legitimate statements, putting money in and out and then presenting those. So I couldn't sit here and tell you that there's any way that we could 100% guarantee that there would not be payslip fraud. If we were to ring every employer, I could say, I work for ANZ, and I could get my friend in the cubicle next to me, give them their number and say, do you work for ANZ? It's just, it's part of doing business. It's something that we have an incredible focus on, but the level of sophistication, we go from very unsophisticated to organised crime.
Understand that, and human systems are human systems.
That's the Royal Commissioner Kenneth Hayne there questioning Guy Mendelson from the ANZ. So, Peter, given these problems with car finance and dodgy practices, is Mr. Mendelson confident that this pretty significant part of the ANZ business has been cleaned up?
Well, that's exactly what Counsel Assisting Albert Dinelli wants to know, given the ANZ's efforts to lift lending standards for its brokers and concerns about poor practices in the industry. And ANZ's Guy Mendelson was initially a bit hesitant to provide an assurance that ANZ was doing the right thing when he was pressed by Albert Dinelli.
With all those changes that you've made sitting here now, though, can you say that the relevant processes that are in place are sufficient to discharge those obligations?
As I said, they've improved, but I can't.
Can you say that they're sufficient to discharge those obligations?
I don't know what the definition of sufficient is.
Well, you're aware of what the responsible lending obligations on the bank
Absolutely.
Are, aren't you?
Absolutely.
And part of that is the reasonable verification of a customer's financial circumstances.
Correct.
You're aware of that?
Correct.
Clearly, income is one of those.
Absolutely.
And can you tell me that the processes as at today are sufficient to discharge ANZ's responsibilities in that regard?
Oh, I don't feel qualified to answer that question.
Well, you're in a very senior role. If
we are making best endeavours, but as I've just explained, if someone is staging bank statements and payslips...
I'm not asking you for a guarantee, Mr. Mendelson.
I would say yes.
That's the ANZ executive Guy Mendelson. Peter, the Royal Commission has also been hearing about insurance products that the ANZ now no longer sells.
Yes, and anyone who's bought a new or used car will know all about this. Things like tyre and rim insurance, which is all about the broker getting a commission. Mr. Mendelson says the ANZ decided to stop selling some of these products in 2016 because most customers didn't make claims. The ANZ became uncomfortable about some of these products and it now only sells loan protection insurance and comprehensive car insurance.
Peter Ryan, the ABC Senior Business Correspondent, thank you. The Launceston Hospital in northern Tasmania has lost its ability to train emergency doctors. The Australasian College of Emergency Medicine says there are no longer enough full-time specialist doctors working at the Launceston Hospital to train the next generation of specialists. It's the result of the hospital's inability to recruit replacement staff after all but two of the doctors in emergency left 18 months ago. Felicity Ogilvie reports from Hobart.
Overcrowding has become common in the emergency department of the Launceston Hospital, and it's led to a heartbreaking situation, according to the Tasmanian Secretary of the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Federation, Emily Shepherd. She says because there aren't enough beds in the hospital wards, the emergency room is often two-thirds full.
What that means for patients is incredibly long times waiting in the waiting room, receiving initial treatment in the waiting room or treatment provided in chairs.
Nurses and doctors there call the overcrowding bed block. And about 18 months ago, a group of the emergency doctors decided it was so bad they quit. Several other doctors also retired, leaving just two of the 11 doctors in emergency. The health department has recruited some new doctors and locums are filling the gaps. But it hasn't been enough to keep staff levels at a point where Launceston can remain a training hospital. And the Tasmanian president of the Australian Medical Association, Stuart Day, says the Australasian College of Emergency Medicine has withdrawn its accreditation.
Essentially, it's about supervision of those trainees, the inconsistent supervision, and that's about having enough Australian ticketed emergency medicine specialists in their department.
He says the trainee doctors are a vital part of the emergency department, but the loss of emergency training accreditation means that from next year, the Launceston Hospital won't be able to train emergency room doctors. Scott Parks is an intensive care unit doctor at the hospital and is also the head of the Medical Staff Association. He hopes the accreditation to train emergency doctors can be won back soon.
The major factor is that we require 5 full-time equivalent specialists, and at the moment we have 4.75. There are 11 full-time equivalent positions available. Recruiting to those is difficult, and it's something we share with most of rural and regional Australia.
It's such a small amount to be short of, just 0.25 of a position. When do you think that could be filled?
We would be hopeful, speaking to my colleagues in emergency, that that may be filled within a few months. There are people who are interested in returning here to work.
Health analyst Martin Goddard says more beds are needed to solve the long waits in the emergency department.
The Launceston General Hospital, in terms of bed block, that is people being backed up in emergency for a long time because they can't get a bed in the hospital, is the worst of all 29 major regional hospitals in the country.
He says emergency waiting times should decrease if more beds are opened on the wards. And the Tasmanian government is promising to open 40 new beds at the Launceston Hospital in the next 6 years. But the nurses' union says at least 14 extra beds could be found and used right now.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. An Australian university is launching a not-for-profit record label in the hopes of promoting music that could otherwise be forgotten. The composer behind the project says it's becoming increasingly hard for musicians to get recording deals because of digital distribution. And it's particularly affecting artists who don't make mainstream music. Sarah Sedgi reports.
Kim Cunio is a composer who considers himself fortunate to have had the career he's had. He's also a senior lecturer in composition and a convener of musicology at the Australian National University. And now he's working with the ANU Press to set up a not-for-profit music label, something he says will be unique.
I think this is the mystery in the whole recording industry. We have this idea that in most record labels, there's, you know, some man or woman in an office who has a pile of records to listen to, and if they like that one in a thousand, they get famous. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to have a register of peers. So in every style of music we work in, we're going to look for people whose work we already admire. And those people are going to be involved in what we call peer reviewing, things that come in. So the idea is, if you're making stuff that your peers think is good, we as a label will be able to support you.
The new label will launch in 2019, providing free distribution of music and research.
The idea that, you know, the record industry, it's seen better days, it's not to say it's dead yet, but we're going to do this thing where money's not the primary focus of it, really great art is. So we're going to be looking for all sorts of musicians in all sorts of genres to make their very best music.
Dr. Cunio says the venture has come about because digital distribution of music is making it harder for many artists to get deals with record labels. He says that's particularly true for musicians who don't make mainstream music. And recent research from the Australian Council for the Arts has found that the average income for professional artists in Australia, including musicians, is about 21% below the workforce average.
I saw myself as one of the lucky ones. But I look at people I know. I know some incredible musicians who've had, maybe they've had publishing deals at some point in their career or record deals at some point, but rarely do they last more than 5 to 10 years. And so then suddenly they're on their own and they're going, how do I sustain this career? And I see this label as the label that can break through really significant people who might be ignored by the mainstream industry, or the ones that can look after some of these people who've fallen through the cracks. Because we're looking to find the people whose music is still truly excellent, truly innovative, and, you know, something maybe quite beautiful. We hope something really remarkable can happen.
Composer Dr. Kim Cunio ending Sarah Sedgie's report. And that's all for the World Today team for this Thursday. I'm Rachel Mealy. Have a lovely afternoon.